that Kathleen sent out, what I wanted to focus our attention on tonight, talk about a little bit, and then maybe discuss, are basically two related themes in the Buddha's teaching. One of those is faith. The Pali word for it is sada, and the literal translation of sada means to place the heart upon, like a foundation, a basis, something trustworthy on which you can, in which your confidence can come to reside. Okay. In Buddha Dharma, the way the Buddha taught the teachings of sada, it is very carefully distinguished from belief. And the most famous teaching of the Buddhas in which he does this is a discourse called the Kalama's Dilemma. It's in the Majjhima Nikaya. The Kalamas were a spiritual community. They're a community of seekers. And what they would do would be to invite different teachers from different traditions to come in and do their shtick, you know, and they would decide, you know, whether this teacher had something on the ball or not. And some of them would follow that teaching for a while. Others, you know, weren't so interested. And so they'd wait for the next one to come along. When the Buddha showed up, he offered his teachings, and they were pestering with questions like, you know, is there a self? Is there not a self? What happens when you die? Stuff like that, which they had been asking everybody who'd come along. And so he shared his views on that. And then somebody asked them, they are a little on the jaded side, well, why should we believe what you have to say any more than we should believe what this clown last week had to say or the person coming next week may have to say? And he said, you shouldn't. Basically, and here's where he made the distinction between faith and belief. He said, if you find yourselves believing in somebody's teaching because other people think he's a real whiz-bang, or because he's really rich or good-looking or has a big following, you know, for any of these various reasons that you might be drawn to this person's teaching, if that's what you're basing your dependence on this teaching on, then you're not in very good shape, you know, because that's like trying to build a house on sand, you know. He said, you should have regard for what I have to tell you only if your goal is my goal. My goal was to determine what are the sources of suffering in life? And he was specifically talking about self-generated suffering, suffering that happens, that we inflict upon ourselves as a result of mental activity, and how that suffering might be brought to an end. He said, if that is your goal as well, these are the insights and these are the practices that I discovered that I have found useful in helping bring suffering to an end in my life. If that's your goal as well, then you may want to try out these practices. And you may want to explore these insights, these teachings I have. If you find that what you are experiencing comports with my teachings, then that is what you should place the heart upon. So what he was saying to the Kalamas, he said, it is well that you should question what I have to teach or say and what anyone else has to teach. Okay. Because it's by this questioning, and this came to be known as noble doubt, okay, the first of three kinds of doubt. He said, it is well that you should investigate, that you should question, that you should not take anybody's word for it, but that you should trust your own spiritual intuition and whether you have the same experience from doing these practices and these and studying these insights that I did. Then you go from noble doubt to what's called verified faith. So there are three kinds of faith in his teachings. One is called bright faith, okay? And that is what happens when one like first discovers the Dharma, you know, and something really rings true. And you become enthused and interested and you want to learn more about it. You're really drawn to it. You think maybe I found my path, you know? And so you begin to explore and investigate. And then as the Buddha said, you do these practices, you study these insights at a deeper and deeper level. And then as you do, if you find that you are indeed gaining insight into a path of freedom from dukkha, you know, this kind of self-generated dukkha, mind-generated dukkha that the Buddha was talking about, and you find that there are glimpses of that freedom that are arising for you in your practice, in your mind, then you have moved from bright faith to what's called verified faith, second kind of faith. The third kind of faith is called abiding faith. Each of these forms of faith happens in sequence over time as one's practice and one's understanding deepens and matures, okay, as it's folded in with life experience, and you begin to determine for yourself whether or not this feels to you like a wise spiritual path to follow, that it's bringing out those qualities in yourself that you value, that you treasure, that others around you who are doing the same practice, it seems to be having the same effect on them. And that is what Sangha is all about. It's being your truest self in the presence of others, others doing the same thing. And as a result, you can basically deepen and strengthen each other's verified faith. Okay. So this relationship between the two, you know, is it's really quite significant, quite important. The shadow side, the reflective side, the other side of the coin, the paired teaching of the Buddhas on matters of faith is on teachings about doubt. First kind of doubt I've already spoken about, noble doubt, which is something the Buddha found to be kind of important along the spiritual path, because without that sense of inquiry, you don't find yourself able to get to the point of verified faith. A second kind of doubt is one of the five hindrances, obstacles to concentration. Okay. And that's in the vernacular is called skeptical doubt. That's noble doubt plus suspicion. Suspicion of the teaching, suspicion of the teacher, okay. Maybe a feeling that someone's trying to get you to enlist in a cult, maybe. Or that there's some aspect of these teachings or the people who are practicing them or following them or the teacher that might actually be harmful to you. And so there's a kind of a self-protectiveness around skeptical doubt. It also has the effect, however, of never getting beyond sticking your toe in the water, you know, of never sufficiently investing oneself in a particular path or teaching to find out what's really going on there. Okay. Skeptical doubt, when it's strong, can really kind of stop somebody in their tracks, right? And so they wind up not doing much of any practice because they're suspicious that every one of them may have its flaws or they may be some way that that it's out to get them. Third form of doubt is actually in some ways going beyond doubt. It's despair. when skeptical doubt becomes so intense, and it can oftentimes be triggered by some kind of particularly painful experience or trauma or something like that, where you were sort of depending on a practice or something to carry you through and it didn't, you know, well, the Buddha hung out this shingle and said, you know, freedom from suffering taught here. So you do it, but you still suffer, you know, so what's that about, you know? And if it gets strong enough, the suffering gets strong enough, then the skeptical doubt can actually turn to despair and a sense that there is no hope, there is no way out, there is no way that I can overcome the mass of suffering that's before me. That kind of, that level of doubt and despair can be pretty deadly, you know, literally. You know, if people are inclined to deep depression and acute anxiety and whatnot, it can really kind of bring them close to the edge. In the time of the, and this isn't just, you know, in our own high stress society, in the time of the Buddha, he had these really ardent disciples. They were these kind of gung-ho macho meditators, you know, they were gonna attain enlightenment in this lifetime, you know, enlightenment or bust and whatnot. And they got busted. Some of them became so despairing, they started to make suicide. And you know, one of the Buddha's little kind of subsects that was cropping up. And so he realized at that point, he really needed to dial back all the talk about striving that, you know, he had brought himself close to the point of starvation, you know, himself, before he realized that this was ego-driven striving and that it was threatening his very existence and that he needed to really fold in some compassion and some patience in order to attain his final goal. And so he started emphasizing that more in his own teaching. So objects of doubt, and the classic objects of doubt in Buddha Dharma are doubt in the teachings, doubt in the teacher, or doubt in oneself. And so what had happened with regard to the Buddha and his suicidal bhikkhus is that they had lost all faith in themselves. Their goal was enlightenment in this lifetime, you know, and that by sheer exercise of will, they should be able to attain it. And if they could not attain it, then it meant they were so flawed that they were hopeless, and that they should simply end their lives. They kind of forgot about the Buddha's teaching on not killing living beings, you know, of which they were one, of course. You know? But it's what happens when, you know, the ego gets carried away with the notion of becoming enlightened. Any one of these three forms of doubt can really have, you know, kind of cast doubt on the others as well. And the strength of faith can help shore either any of them up. So I wanted to offer a little, you know, personal story about this business of self-doubt. I was raised in a religiously conservative home where from an early age I was taught that I always could or should be doing better at anything I was doing than I was at the time, especially schoolwork. And I was also taught of the inherent tendency towards sinfulness, and that I needed to always be on guard because there was kind of like this landmine living inside of me, you know, that if I stepped on it was going to blow me to hell. Sharon Salzberg, one of my root teachers and a good friend, Dharma friend, when a lot of people would come to her retreats and talk about having been raised that way, and it happens in all traditions, you know, she would describe them as spiritually wounded because they had been raised to doubt themselves. They had been raised to rely on some external authority figure, usually a male teacher in their tradition, to make them whole again, you know. And that they, without that, they were nothing. They were in peril. Okay. It's pretty common child rearing practice in Western cultures. Its intent is to instill a constant impetus to striving, you know, but can also instill a strong sense of self-doubt and a negative self-view. And one that, you know, this deep sense that one is somehow or another never quite measuring up. For me, it didn't begin to resolve until I came home from Vietnam and did well in college and fell in love and got married and developed some lasting friendships. But that relentless sense of perfectionism never really left, you know, and it persisted, you know, even though I went on to like considerable success, you know, and academia, getting a PhD from a hotshot university and, you know, good job at CU and all that kind of thing. There is this still this kind of emptiness of this hunger dating back to my childhood, you know, when it was the feeling was that I was never quite good enough. And so for that reason, also not worthy of unconditional love, you know, from my folks. So there is this, you know, when I came across this story, I just said, yes, yes. And the story first appeared on the San Francisco Chronicle in 1979, and then was published by other newspapers, and it led to an exchange of correspondence. In 1979, the San Francisco Chronicle hosted a dinner party for all the Nobel laureates living in the Bay Area. And they were all faculty at either Stanford or UC Berkeley. At this gathering, the Stanford physicist, Nobelist William Shockley, went around trying to recruit donors to a Nobel sperm bank. It had been set up by a wealthy friend and fellow eugenicist in Southern California. Shockley was a well-known racist kook who spoke admiringly of Hitler's efforts to selectively breed a white master race, and thought that we should be doing the same thing. On reading this news in the Boston Globe, a feminist activist there wrote to the paper saying, "Sperm banks, they should have an egg bank. Why just sperm?" In response, George Wald, a biologist at Harvard, who'd won the 1967 Nobel Prize in Medicine, wrote this letter to the paper. "You're right, Pauline. It takes an egg as well as a sperm to start a Nobel laureate. Every one of them had a mother as well as a father. Say all you want of fathers, their contribution to conception is really rather small." Nobel laureates aside, there isn't much technically in the way of starting an egg bank. There are some problems, but nothing so hard as involved in other kinds of breeder reactors. But think of a man so vain as to insist on getting a superior egg from an egg bank. Then he has to fertilize it. And when it's fertilized, what does he do with it? Go to his wife? "Here, dear," you can hear him say, "I just got this superior egg from an egg bank and just fertilized it myself. Will you take care of it?" "I've got my own eggs to worry about," she replies. "You know what you can do with your superior egg. Go rent a womb. And while you're at it, you better get a room too." You see, it just won't work. For the truth is that what one really needs is not Nobel laureates, but love. How do you think one gets to be a Nobel laureate? Wanting love, that's how. Wanting it so bad that one works all the time and ends up with a Nobel laureate. It's a consolation prize. What matters is love. Forget sperm banks and egg banks. Banks and love are incompatible. If you don't know that, you don't know bankers. So just practice loving. Love a Russian. You'd be surprised how easy it is and how it will brighten up your morning. Love whales, Iranians, Vietnamese, not just here, but everywhere. When you've gotten really good at it, you can even try loving some of our politicians. So for me, the only thing that Wall left out of his long list in his final paragraph is loving yourself. You know, it's that lack that feeds the hunger for achievement in every other realm. To be denied love when young creates a hunger that may never be truly sated until self-love can be realized. And this love is not at the expense of or to the exclusion of love for others. It is, in fact, the origin point, seeing yourself not as different from, not as separate from others. Benito Juarez in the 19th century Mexico was the first indigenous chief justice in the Mexican Supreme Court, and he later became the first indigenous president of Mexico. And in that capacity, he once said, entre los individuos como entre naciones, respecto al derecho ajeno es la paz. Between individuals as well as between nations, respect for the rights of the other is peace. Davuda once said, you know, and asked about self-love or self-regard, he said, you know, I visited the four corners of creation or the cosmos in my mind, nor anywhere did I find anyone less deserving the love than myself, nor anyone more. It's that kind of love is the universe loving itself. You know. So objects of faith in Buddha Dharma. First is faith in oneself. So given my tendency toward, you know, self-deprecation and self-doubt, I was surprised and touched when I was asked to enter into a seminary program at Spirit Rock Meditation Center back in 1997. It was a seminary program called the Community Dharma Leaders Training Program. And I went there and we were trained to host and lead sitting groups, establish sanghas, and otherwise spread the Dharma at the community level, because all of our own teachers were only teaching on retreats. You know, we'd get together, we have a retreat, and everyone would go home. And so we're looking to do some kind of more continuous Dharma presence at the community level nationally. And so one of the things you were supposed to do if you went through this training was to teach meditation classes and maybe start a sitting group. And so my assignment is part of what got us here. I graduated from that program in the year 2000 and was trained by, you know, some extraordinarily skilled senior teachers in this tradition, and began to teach. And we began to meet as a sangha. You know, you were my homework. and we, you know, we got a good thing up and running here. In 2001, one of my root teachers, Joseph Goldstein, who was to become my principal Dharma teaching mentor for the next 20 years, invited me to come to a retreat that was being held in the Catskill Mountains. No, not the Catskill, the Berkshires in Western Massachusetts. And it was a retreat for law professors and law students, introducing them to the Dharma. Okay. Some of them had gone through stress reduction stuff and whatnot, but this is introducing them to the Dharma in a secular format for the most part. And so I assumed Joseph just wanted me to come along because, I had a background in the law by that time and was teaching law and public policy here at CU. And so I got there and we were out walking in the woods before the retreat began. And I said, well, is there any role that you would like me to play here? He said, yes. He said, I want you to teach metta to this group. And I had never taught much outside, this sangha at all at that time, a few short retreats. It's like, whoa, okay. So he was asking me to take on this role that I never had before. He said, I also want you to lead small group interviews, which is another level of teaching responsibility. And I said, wow, I'll give it a try, but this is kind of the deep end for me. And he listened to me talking about, sort of my misgivings or not being sure I was entirely qualified. Listen for a while. He said, what I'm hearing is self-doubt. Said, you need to understand that I would not ask you to do these things if I did not know that you could do them and if I did not know you could do them well. It's very touching. It was like he planted this seed of faith in myself. It was really powerful and it manifested on that retreat. The people who were on that retreat were mostly from New England and the New York area and whatnot. And the retreat was held a month after 9/11. And he wanted me to teach metta. And so we gathered in the meditation hall for the session where I was going to be teaching. And I closed my eyes and settled in, watching the breathing, trying to get ready for, this new step in my teaching career. And I could hear people coming, getting settled in. It got quiet. And I opened my eyes to start teaching. And Joseph was sitting right square in front of me. Oh, okay. Well, here I am getting ready to teach metta to, one of the leading Theravada teachers in the Western world. Okay. But he was there as an expression of faith, expression of confidence, of support. And so began to teach metta. And then people were asking, so you want me to send loving kindness to Osama bin Laden? My response was no, not really. I think that when we're doing this practice, the thing that's most important for you to do is to decide who it feels you would most benefit from receiving these expressions of well-wishing. I said, probably for nearly everybody here, it's yourselves. And so we did a lot of self-meta practice on that retreat. And it's also what we discussed in the sitting group that I led. So having someone else repose that kind of faith and confidence to you can really, really develop it in yourself. Over the last 20 years or so, a lot of my sense of faith in myself and teaching and studying the Dharma has come from you. You all are a really, really important reason why I have found it possible to teach the Dharma over the years. Your faith and confidence in me, your faith and confidence in each other, in yourselves, that's what the Dharma does. It plants these seeds that begin to bloom and flourish and become recognizable to us as our own innate spiritual integrity coming forth. and bring forth in us things we didn't even know were there in terms of how we regard ourselves and how we regard each other and how we treat each other. Okay. So faith in this Sangha, you know, it comes with faith in yourselves. We've been together now for about 20 years. Among our core founding members were members of various recovery groups around the Denver area. One of the most pernicious effects of dependency, whether it's drugs, alcohol, food, or anything else upon which a detrimental reliance develops, is that it erodes self-confidence. It erodes confidence or trust in one's ability to take care of oneself. And one of the benefits of most recovery programs, whatever form they take, is that it is undertaken in community with others. It's being in community with others where one discovers how to be supported, how to be positively regarded, even if you don't happen to have very much positive regard for yourself in the moment. Okay. So recovering together in community can build that kind of faith in oneself that may have been eroded or nearly destroyed. It helps it. It's part of the healing process that can bring one back to put one back on the path of healing and of wholeness, right? It doesn't happen in this path by oneself. It happens in community with others. It's another name for Sangha. It's how we literally take care of each other. Provides this network, this opportunity for us to kind of take care of each other. The relationship between teacher and Sangha can be mutually enriching, but it can also be fraught. If Sangha has become too dependent on teachers, and those teachers have unexplored shadow sides that manifest and unskillful behavior, an understandable loss of trust in the teacher and the teachings can lead to awakening, weakening, or even a disintegration of Sangha. We have several unfortunate, spectacular examples of that, whether it's at the San Francisco Zen Center or, you know, Trungpa's region at Shambhala, our very own tradition. We have the example of Dharma punks in the Against the Stream Sangha, where seriously unresolved issues with the very charismatic leader, Noah Levine, led to the actual collapse of the entire organization. In my own experience, some physical and mental health issues, you know, have arisen for me that have from time to time caused me to doubt my own ability to teach the Dharma and our Sangha with the authority and depth that I think it deserves. This also means I've begun to doubt my ability to contribute and to serve the Sangha at the level that I have been over the last 20 years. In times gone by, my faith in myself as a Dharma teacher has been sustained by doing retreats with my own root teachers and others who I trust and can grow from Dharma study, and by interpersonal contact with members of our Sangha and our sitting group. But during these last 2 years of the COVID pandemic, those opportunities have not been so available to me. I'm finding that I'm not feeling that same sense of being spiritually nourished by myself, nourishing of myself when I'm teaching online. It's one of the reasons I'm hoping that we'll be able to continue to meet in person as well as online, if it seems safe and reasonable to do so, because I really feel nourished and supported and sustained when we can get together. I'm not planning to step down from teaching, but I may not be engaged to quite the same level of energy and activity going forward. So I wanted to convey that sense to the Sangha. I don't want to so deplete myself now that I can't be of service in the future. And I want to do what I can to help the Sangha sustain itself and grow and become increasingly self-reliant as time goes by. So my study and my practice work right now involves reflection on the restoration and the practice of restoration of faith in myself and my own Buddha nature as both a continuing student of the Dharma and as a teacher. What's also been really helpful during this difficult period for me has been expressions of support and kind regard from members of this Sangha. I'd begun to forget that the supportive and respectful relationship between teacher and Sangha is a two-way street, and that we can be here for each other in times of need. In doing this work, I also remembered and reread some teachings on the subject by my friend and Root Dharma teacher, Sharon Salzberg. In her 2002 book on faith, she says this. For those who aspire to the freedom from suffering taught by the Buddha, the primary repository of abiding faith is faith in our own Buddha nature. Because Buddhist teachings arise out of the experience of a human being rather than being conferred by a deity, great emphasis is placed on the abiding faith in oneself, in one's actual experience, and in one's true capabilities. Lack of faith in our own potential limits our sense of possibility to habitual concepts. It keeps us from sensing who we might yet become or how we needlessly circumscribe our lives. Whatever we might be conditioned to believe, the teachings say that beneath our small, constricted, self-identified identity lies the innate capacity for awareness and love that is Buddha nature. That is what faith in ourselves rests upon. Let's sit for a moment. Well, so far it's been all about me. What I'd like to hear about now is you. Anything that I may have said tonight about faith, about doubt, about faith in oneself, in your Buddha nature, faith in the teachings, faith in this Sangha, what happens when it's absent, what do you do? Any questions you may have or experiences you may want to share? Now is the time. And this, of course, holds true for the people I'm looking at on my screen as well as those in the room. So please.
Yeah, Bill. My experience of the Dharma was starting when I was still working, and I was kind of at a low point in my career. I was really having a difficult time. And I was, my confidence, I'm sure, was down. And by practicing, learning to practice, of course, I had that great initial buzz.
Yes.
You know, but it really helped me to carry on my work. And my boss told me on more than one occasion, said, gosh, you're doing so well now. You're just, you know, shining, you know. So I made those last 3 or 4 years really wonderful, and my confidence was up. And it was nice to go on a high note. So I had a similar, you know, I had an experience of growing confidence and stability with the Dharma.
Yeah, good. Thank you. It's like finding a part of yourself you didn't even know was there, right?
Yeah.
It's like, whoa, where did you come from? Yeah, good. Thanks. I appreciate you sharing that. Please. Joe.
Yeah, I mean, I think I can relate to the issues with Zoom. And like, for me as a counselor, trying to feel in some way fulfilled in my career, when I have to primarily do it, you know, Zoom. And for me, I've had some of my own struggles with faith and fulfillment and where does my motivation come from? And what's helped me with that is looking at some of my past and looking at how much I needed to believe that was maybe part of a means of survival.
Yes.
Like, I needed to believe in something because that was so important for me just to get out of that situation.
Right.
But what I actually was believing in may not have been something that, you know, had the ability to sustain itself.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, there's a real paradox there. Because at some point you sort of start to see through that. You know?
Yeah.
And there's a tremendous amount of despair.
Yes.
Because it's like, you know, then it's sort of like you know, where do you go from there? The source of so much of your motivation, you recognize in some ways, it's just not totally substantial, but continue to substantiate that.
Yes.
In the future. And so it just takes some time to kind of rebuild and to repair and sort of figure out, you know,
Yeah. Thank you. The one analogy that I've heard used in this Theravada tradition is of what you're describing. It's a little bit like a monkey swinging from vine to vine. You know, you try something out and you say, well, maybe not. And then you grab another vine and you try that out for a while. But, you know, even through that process, it got you here. You know, it's like, even though you may be swinging from vine to vine for a while, it's like, whoa, it's almost like I can fly. I can move. I can continue to investigate. And then at some point, you've heard it said, the journey is the destination. At some point, that sincere impetus, you know, and in the Visuddhimagga, it's like a bird homing, you know, flying home, returning to the source, you know, that eventually you begin to get your bearings, right? And so as that begins to happen more and more, then that confidence, you know, that, yeah, this is turning into a path. This is getting me, you know, I did a lot of interesting stuff by way of spiritual seeking in the Bay Area before coming across the Dharma. Yeah. But he got us here, you know.
I mean, I think for me, in some ways, it's like the comfort, you know, having the comfort in my life to be able to see that how much I needed to believe in something,
yeah,
and how bad it was at some point in time. In some ways, like, things fell apart, but at least I was in a little bit better place.
And you were continuing to inquire, continuing to search. Yeah. Yeah. Please. Others. You think?
Go. Self-doubt. I've lived with self-doubt most of my life. Like a lot of us, I was raised in a background that was basically Calvinist. That we were, there was just something, and Christianity, you know, original sin. There's just something wrong with us, apparently, right from the get-go. And my grandfather, Durham grandfather, was the archetypal Dallas God. He just projected all of that negativity.
Mm-hmm.
And I had difficulty all through school and stuff. And I was always kind of on the edge of trouble in most everything. And finally, when I was 59, I found out why I have ADD. So I had a condition of impulsivity and lack of attention and stuff that was in my way. I had considered the fatal flaw,
mm-hmm.
you know, from the Calvinist background. So since that age 59, I've been able to like myself a lot more.
Good. Good. You know, it's never too late. Right? You know, when I was a little kid in my, you know, I was in the Baptist church, and they, you know, one of the kind of the adages about them is they multiply by division. They get in these big rows, and they, you know, take their dollies and go home, and they stomp off in different directions and start another church. And but when all this was going on, I remember I had an aunt, I think it was one of my Texas relatives. She gave me this little, it was called a red letter edition of the New Testament. It's just this little short thing. And it had the actual words, the actual teachings that Jesus of Nazareth was thought to have shared in red type. And so you could just flip through it, you know, it's just, you know, and he didn't really have much to say, you know, they whacked him after only 3 years. So he didn't have a chance to get a lot across. You know, Buddha roamed around teaching for 45 years, and all his combined transcribed teachings runs to almost 10,000 pages, small type, you know, in English. But anyway, my aunt said, well, you know, with all this stuff that's going on in the church, and when I just read the red stuff, she said, just, you know, just focus on that, you know, what he actually said, right? And reading that, I found that Jesus wasn't much of a fire and brimstone teacher at all. You know, he taught about love and acceptance and tolerance, and hung out with people that were pretty close to the bottom of the social pile. So much of, you know, what gets handed down just doesn't really have much to do with the teachings, but all the stuff that kind of grows up around them. And I wish my aunt had been my preacher. Because all she spoke about was love. Thank you. For folks online, if you want to use the hand raising emoji, that's the best way I can recognize if you have something you want to say or to share. Paul? Oh yeah, please.
Speaking of love is a little tricky, and I was wondering if you could do your thoughts on. So Ajahn Tanasaro actually says that metta is mistranslated as, you know, we often think of it as love, mm-hmm. and he said that no, that's pema. And that really, metta is actually the best translation he came up with, was goodwill. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could kind of comment on that, particularly in all sports work, and also what we were just talking about with Christianity and the notion of love there.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think my
For those on the phone, it looks like Tara Lloyd has frozen, and so we might be at the end of our transmission.
Hard. Nope. Got people more kind of open-hearted to universal love. And if you really, you know, have a careful read of the Karaniya Metta Sutta, you know, the discourse on the practice of metta, right? You'll find that what the Buddha seems to be getting at is to the importance of regarding yourself and the other without boundaries, without a sense of me loving you or me having kind regard for you. Okay, so it's like saying, well, I like the color of my eyes, but I don't like my left thumb. It's, he's that full part is the do not distinguish. Okay. And so what Sharon was talking about, having faith in yourself, having kind regard for yourself, you know, what Tara Brach calls reparenting, you know, the reestablishing of that sense of wholeness, of that spiritual healing. Okay. It is, you know, in Buddha Dharma, it is both the journey and the destination, right? But when the heart mind is in that space, there is no difference between self and other. And so the kind regard, the love that one feels for oneself is not any different than the love that one feels for another. So it's not interpersonal, it's not transactional, it's not self and other, ultimately. It's the universe loving itself when we open in that way. And so that's just another take on it. There are a lot of folks out there that teach that practice in different ways and use different language for it. It's the underlying intent that really matters, though. And when I read the Karaniya Metta Sutta, just as a mother protects her child, her only child, with her life if need be, so too may we cherish all living beings, suffusing the entire world with unobstructed, you can call it loving kindness, you can call it regard, with our own Buddha nature.
I want to tell you that when you, in one of the Dharma talks, shared about your struggles with alcohol.
Yes.
That was very, very moving.
Is what?
Very moving.
Yes.
That I'm aware of the transgressions of other teachers, and I often wonder what would help that. And there's something you're humanizing with. Your teacher that you think is all this says, I too struggle with that. So I was very personally, it really woke me up. It really opened my heart, and it opened my heart to everybody here because we all have those kinds of stories.
Yes.
So that's one thing. The other thing I want to say is that the self-doubt that I felt has been very recent. My mom died recently. She was on long descent and had to be on hospice. And mm-hmm. I was quite frightened of what the factors of my siblings and I together, as Bill attest, saw us at the memorial, and very powerful personalities, very powerful versions. And I had a lot of self-doubt, but my mother had always wanted us to stay together. That was her wish. And so her death was actually very building for me in terms of watching myself be able to let go, to communicate only what was wholesome, and to deal with my aversion in other ways than lashing out. So I was very moved by that whole experience of being there when she died, but knowing that her wish was actually being carried out every time I interacted with my siblings. And you know, if you've been through something like that, you know how completely without people get.
Yes.
At some point, my sister, you know, had parked her car with her keys in her, my brother's car with the keys in her wallet right there, and got stolen, and they were up by Lafayette trying to find it. And this was a day before my mom died. So there's all sorts of craziness happening. But I'm very moved by teachers such as yourself who are talking in real time about your struggles, because it's such a, it's just a human thing to put you on a pedestal. So thank you so much.
Well, I appreciate your kind words, and this Sangha and my love of the Dharma, my caring for everyone here and everyone on the screen, is energizing and profoundly helpful insofar as my own healing process is concerned. And it's for that reason that I really have resolved that I need to be able to teach the Dharma with authenticity and with due respect for its power, you know. And so I do not intend to do less than that when I'm teaching. And so when I speak in somewhat provisional terms, it's because, you know, for those of you who are walking the path of recovery, you know that it's a day by day, step by step process. But it's my kind regard for myself, for the Dharma and the Sangha, that's turning out to be really helpful going forward, including the, you know, the words you just shared with me. So we've gone and burned through another two perfectly good hours. Let's take just a moment before we go our separate ways tonight to remember the blessings that we experience from the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So may there be every blessing chant. Mbhavatu sava mangalam rakantu sava devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sabha Buddha Nubhavena Sada Soti Bhavantute. By the power of all the Buddhas, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sava Mangalam Rakantu Sava Devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sabha Dhamma Nubhavena Sada Soti Bhavantute. By the power of all the dharmas, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sava Mangalam Rakantu Sava Devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava Sangha Nubhavena Sada Soti Bhavantute. By the power of all the Sangha, May you always be well. Mbhavatu sava mangalam rakantu sava devata. May there be every blessing, and may all the devas protect you. Thanks for coming around this evening. I had a wonderful time. I hope you did too. We meet every Sunday right here now, as well as online. I'll see you again in 2 weeks.
Thank you.